You're listening to Real Talk, sponsored by Marcus Werenberg Theaters. I'm Colin Ritter.
And I'm Peter Lewis.
And today's episode is the Steven Spielberg special. So, as many people know, Steven Spielberg is one of my favorite directors of all time. If you've listened to any of our past episodes, this is very evident. I talk about him quite frequently and his movies, so this should be a lot of fun.
This is basically just a piece you like. Here you go, Colin.
Exactly.
We know what you want to talk about.
Exactly. You know, we're doing this just for me, essentially. But this episode is going to consist of a few different things. We're going to go through his filmography. We're going to kind of quickly skim over it, leave some parts out here and there. We're going to talk about our favorite films that he's ever been a part of, and then we're going to talk about the different elements that Steven Spielberg puts into his films that we think makes him so successful and makes his films so timeless, essentially.
It's going to be a little more different because unlike, you know, our past, you know, listing of films we like, we're going to focus more on the specific person involved in these films. Like, we'll talk about specific things he does in these films that makes them great, but we're not really going to be like, oh, I love this film because of this storyline. It's more like, what did Spielberg do to make us like this film?
Exactly. That's exactly right. So I think what we should do is just get started from the very beginning of it all. So now, this is, I don't want to say it's convoluted, but we have a couple different starting points we could really delve into this. But this may be sacrilege to some people, but we're going to leave out the Sugarland Express, and we're going to start in 1975 with Jaws. I think that's a pretty fitting place to start with Steven Spielberg. I think most people will know him for Jaws more than they'll know him for the Sugarland Express. Although we've both seen that film, I think this is just a good starting point.
It's kind of like what, you know, George Lucas, like, his first big film was American Graffiti, but again, everybody knows what got him on the map.
Star Wars.
And again,
exactly.
Same thing with Spielberg. Sugarland Express was his first big film, but Jaws is what really made that name synonymous with film at the time.
Exactly. I mean, 1975, a film that had a $9 million budget and grossed $470 million in the box office. I mean, that's incredible.
And as we talk about so much on the show, you know, just the technical difficulties of that movie
to make.
But again, we can finally talk about Spielberg in detail here. You know, just that vision to work with that when, you know, probably a lot of beginning filmmakers would probably have thought of that as, you know, the end of the film or the biggest challenge.
Exactly. You know, The Shark in particular, and I know that's what you're alluding to, The Shark didn't work, you know, 95% of the time. But when it did work, they had to make sure that they got the shot. But what they ended up doing, and I know that you know this, they adapted the film to the fact that it wasn't working. They adapted it to the fact that the mechanics weren't working at all. And it made the film much more scary, you know, because it relied on that suspense, kind of hinting at a lot of Alfred Hitchcock's tactics that he used back in the day, you know, mastering suspense and using the most of that moment to really connect with the crowd and the audience.
And one of the things of beginning filmmakers is, you know, they don't really like to change much of their films because, you know, think this is what got me, you know, this is what the studio agreed to.
Exactly.
I was like, well, you know what? I can't get this to work. So you know what? Gonna have to change it on the fly here.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, again, kind of a good thing about Spielberg that we're going to see a lot talking about his films that he's been involved in. He understands characters well.
Oh, absolutely.
He understands the idea of escapism, because that's what he's most famous for. There's the obvious big outlier in 1993 that we'll, of course, get to.
Yeah.
But for the most part, Spielberg's a guy that likes to have fun, and I can respect that.
Yeah, I mean, I really think you could go down as saying he is kind of the master of escapism. He is definitely the master of adventure films. I mean, his filmography, which we have right in front of us, is ridiculously extensive. I mean, it goes on forever. The films that he has worked on, the list literally goes on forever. And I mean, Jaws, no exception, just an incredible film. The story behind the movie is incredible. You know, Steven Spielberg, very young director at the time, kind of just happens into this position where he's going to be directing this film. One that, you know, it was kind of up in the air if it was going to be successful or not. I mean, as with many movies, you know, that's a fair assessment. But being such a young director, the studio was placing a lot of faith in him, and especially the ending scene. Which, if you haven't seen Jaws, spoiler alert, you know, the shark is exploded, you know, exploded, grammar. Anyways, he's holding a scuba tank in his mouth. The scuba tank gets shot, and then he's blown into a million pieces throughout the air. And that was like a very controversial part of this film. The studio heads and the other people working on the film told Steven, they said, do not end the movie like this. It's not believable. Your audience is not going to be with you. And his response was, if I've had them for 2 hours, they'll remain with me for 3 minutes while I blow this shark up. And it worked. It's so true.
From a logical standpoint, I think that's what's great about him as a filmmaker. He understands how film works.
He does.
That's completely right. You know, if you can get me involved in the first hour, at that point, I'm going to be a little more understanding of what you're trying to do. If you don't give me that first hour, sorry, I'm kind of not going to be believing. But again, he builds up to that moment so well. He makes the shark this perfect villain.
Yeah.
And it's almost like you want these people on the boat to, you know, get rid of the shark by any means necessary. And you know what? That's the way they found out to do it. You know what? They took it.
Exactly. Another good use of the environment. You know, kind of like we've talked about, you know, there were a lot of things that went wrong in this movie. And I know we're dwelling a lot on Jaws, but you have to dwell a lot on the movie that kind of built the man. But he also knows how to work with those problems. He knows how to turn those problems into, I guess I could say, a positive in very vague terms, because he can play with them in a way that it almost makes the film better, you know, utilizing those problems, because I think you have to think outside the box more and you have to be more creative.
It almost felt like he just had his first script for Jaws was basically a draft of what to do, and then he just realized, well, this isn't going to work 100% of the time, so got to go with the punches. And again, you know, talking about the behind-the-scenes aspect of film, you know, he was filming this, you know, of course, on location, and, you know, there's that famous story about, you know, they had to make it look like they were all in an empty ocean when in reality it wasn't. So they had to wait. They had like a 10-minute span every, like, what, 20 or so minutes to get the boats in the background out of the shot. It's like he basically had to put up a challenge, you know, with the local environment. You know, they weren't just going to let this no-name director at the time, you know, just come
exactly.
in and shut it. Like nowadays, he could get that whole area shut down for 5 months if he wanted to.
You have to understand, this movie was filmed just off of Martha's Vineyard. It was shot right off of Chappaquiddick Island, which until this point had not been a hot spot for filmmaking. So it was a very touchy subject, the fact that this Hollywood crew was kind of taking over this entire area. But not to take credit away from others, so Steven Spielberg had an incredible cast and crew working on this movie, no doubt about it. He had some incredible writers. He had some incredible actors. I mean, I've said it time and time again, one of my favorite monologues from any movie of all time is Robert Shaw's monologue. He played Quint in the film. He gives the monologue on board the Orca, which is the boat that they're on when they're, you know, they're going after the shark. When he talks about, you know, the sinking ship, and you know how when a shark seems lifeless until it bites you, and then the black eyes roll over to white. I mean, just such gruesome detail, but it's so entrancing as a viewer. And I can't say enough good things about Jaws. One of my favorite movies of all time. And of course, if you've listened to our top 10 movies episode, you know that by now.
If you made it through all that, good for you.
Yeah, if you made it through that, good for you. So I guess moving on, we can move to 1977 and talk about one of Peter's favorite movies of all time. I would say so. Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
I talked about the film before. I think what Spielberg does great is that, I think I already said it, he puts these mostly no-name characters, not you know, actors, of course, the characters themselves, just, you know, average people in these very big situations.
Yeah.
And I think that's what he does great with Richard Dreyfuss in this film, you know, just this everyday electrical worker from Indiana. UFOs are going on across the world, and it directly impacts him and his family. And then she's, you know, it's like, well, I got to figure out what's going on. And just a great, he understands adventure. Like, he understands, like, how to get from point A to point B, which is what everybody wants when you introduce, you know, the problems of the film.
Yeah.
But in between, he has a lot of stuff between A and B to make you really want to get to B.
Yeah.
Which is it's kind of a hard thing, especially repeatedly. Like, he has this in a lot of his films.
Oh, yeah.
And you'd think eventually, like, this formula would start breaking down, but he understands how to make characters for each film in each situation. And this is where it kind of begins, because, you know, science fiction at this time, you know, it was basically B-movie, so bad it's good type movies, you know.
Yeah.
You have this gimmick for, basically, just basically a gimmick, and you have the main characters go, you know, fight, do what they do. This was I think this was probably the artistic way of doing sci-fi before, you know, you got the Terminators, the aliens of the, you know, filmography world.
Oh, I completely agree. And something I forgot to mention on Jaws, which is completely transferable into Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the music. Steven Spielberg developed a good relationship with composer John Williams during Jaws, and subsequently he worked on almost every major motion picture that Steven Spielberg would go on to do throughout the rest of his career, and even today he's, you know, it's hard to find a Spielberg movie that doesn't have a touch of John Williams on it, but he did the music for Close Encounters as well.
And a great thing about music in Close Encounters was how they communicate
exactly
with the aliens.
Which is brilliant.
I guess if we ever do a favorite scenes episode, that I would probably put that.
Oh, no doubt.
Way high, because, you know, again, every time you have a movie with aliens and humans, you know, coming to Earth and all that stuff, it's always, you know, they're attacking us, they're trying to enslave us, trying to take our, something like that.
Yeah.
This, I think, I like to think, I do think there's life out there, and mm-hmm. if they were to come here, I think it would probably go down like that. I think it would be like, well, let's try to get them culturally. And it's like, let's play music at them, see how they, like, that I think is the most interesting idea, and it's never been done since, really.
Yeah, and that's when the U.S. federal government calls, says, hey, John, you want to come down here? We have a situation. We need you to talk to some aliens, please. And that's how that would go. But yeah, Close Encounter of the Third Kind, a movie I saw relatively young with my dad. My dad always showed me some great movies. I'm very thankful for that. Another movie I saw very young. Definitely a great movie. Moving on to 1978, we have I Want to Hold Your Hand, which we're not going to talk a whole lot about. We're going to move on to 1979 when we have 1941, mm-hmm. which again, another one of my favorite Spielberg movies of all time. I love John Belushi. It's hilarious. It's a riot. It's such a funny movie, such a fun movie to watch. Again, which is pretty constant with Spielberg, an all-star cast. And then in 1980, we have The Blues Brothers, where he was actually, he had a small acting part in that film.
Next to RoboCop, I would say one of the greatest films of all time.
Used Cars, which he was executive producer. Continental Divide, 1981. And then later in 1981, we have another one of my top five favorite movies of all time, Raiders of the Lost Ark. I mean, I've gone on record and said it once. I think I like the Indiana Jones franchise more than I like Star Wars, which is sacrilegious to some people because I'm obsessed with both. But oh my gosh, Steven Spielberg and George Lucas working together on Raiders of the Lost Ark, probably one of the most brilliant things I can imagine, and it held up to the hype. I mean, really, if you think about it.
I mean, some of the best casting I think I've ever seen in a film. Actors that understood what the characters were, because again, like we said, Spielberg understands characters more than anything else.
Yeah.
And to get actors that will understand it with him,
mm-hmm.
that's the biggest advantage you can have. And again, this is just such a fun story.
It is. And I mean, listen to this. I mean, how great is that music? I mean, give me a
it
break.
Establishes,
come on.
It establishes an adventure is about to go down.
It does.
And you're going to remember it. Even we'll get to Temple of Doom. Even though that's considered the black sheep of the franchise,
yeah,
it's still, you can still watch it,
you can.
Easily.
It establishes, I mean, Indiana Jones, first and foremost, is one of the coolest characters you can think of. I mean,
I'm not going to lie, I think I like Harrison Ford's Indiana Jones way more than I like Han Solo.
I absolutely do. No questions asked.
Because you can tell he actually enjoys the role.
He does. He definitely enjoys
it. It didn't ruin his life. We're like,
exactly.
Like, what's it like to be Han Solo? Like, forget that. What's it like to be Indiana Jones?
Indiana Jones,
I feel
like
he would absolutely love to talk about that more than
exactly
being Han Solo.
And one thing that Steven Spielberg definitely took advantage of was the use of practical sets and practical special effects. I think Indiana Jones is honestly one of the best representations of practical sets of any movie of this era. The sets for this film were massive, and this was again remained constant throughout all of the indie films and a lot of Spielberg's films. I mean, this remained constant with E.T. I mean, obviously Jaws, they were in the ocean. But the sets are just, they're gorgeous. I mean, the attention to detail is incredible. And just, gosh, a fun adventure story.
And, you know, like we said before, you know, it's basically paying homage, you know, like the original serials of all, you know, film past. And it just works so well. And, you know, I always love when they go transition to locations. You know, they have that famous graphic.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it feels like it's a film from the 40s that was legitimately made in the 80s.
Yeah, you're exactly right.
It's kind of hard to do, you know, retro filmmaking years after it happened.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about La La Land a lot. You know, it kind of got to that point.
Yeah.
But this is the one I would say, yeah, dead on.
Oh,
it felt
without
like,
a doubt.
You know, 40s, 30s, 50s filmmaking.
And again, that's why it's one of my top favorite movies of all time. Then in 1982, we have E.T., classic. I mean, what is there to say about E.T.? It's such a good movie.
Can't say much of it. Yeah, it's like hard to say something new about
it. It's so hard to talk about some of Steven Spielberg's movies because I feel like everything has already been said about them.
Because everybody knows what you're talking about. But
E.T.?
again, you're just this, like a Close Encounters of the Third Kind, but you know, with a small child now. It's like, you know, hey, here's this interesting thing. Here's an alien. See what you can do with this.
Exactly.
And he does, really.
Yeah. Also a great attraction at Universal Studios Orlando. Poltergeist, also in 1982. Classic there.
It's a fun film.
It is a fun film, no doubt about it.
I can't say it ever scared me. Even as a child, I was like, yeah. I just enjoyed it. It was like so weird.
It definitely creeped me out. I'll definitely say that. It was creepy.
But I just love the idea of it is just so, a lot of Spielberg films are very well known in terms of pop culture.
Oh yeah.
Like I feel like even if you haven't seen Poltergeist, you could see like a parody clip of some on some show of it and you'd be like, oh yeah, I definitely know what that is.
You know what it's alluding to, yeah, without a doubt. Moving on, we have 1984, we have Gremlins, classic. I mean, again, we could literally go down this entire list. I mean, we have, let's see here, we have up until 2018, so movies that aren't even out yet, and we're literally just going to go down the list and say, wow, that's a classic, that's a classic, that's a classic.
Steven Spielberg in the 80s and 90s, that's all you can say. Like he,
it is.
That was his peak.
Oh, without a doubt.
That's when he was involved so well and just so many good projects.
And as we've talked about, the 70s and 80s were, I mean, I think something we could both agree on, that was the last true, I don't want to say golden age, but the true height of Hollywood
mm-hmm.
as far as quality, you know?
Oh,
so,
yeah.
I mean, there's just so many good movies coming out. Later on in 1984, we have Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. As we've kind of talked about, mm-hmm. until Kingdom of the Crystal Skull came out, was considered not the best, but obviously Indiana Jones 4 kind of took that trophy. So now, Temple of Doom, I'm like, you know what? I can watch it and be fine with it.
I think its only big problem was films like these kind of needed that supporting character. And I don't think that's what Temple of Doom had going for it. Short one's great.
Oh, he's great.
Oh, God, I forget the actor's name, but I know he played Data in Goonies, which hands him we're about to get to.
Yeah, we're about to get to Goonies.
It's a fun child actor. It's just, after that, everything works.
Yeah.
It's like the idea of like, oh, you know, Indiana Jones went from, you know, getting the Ark of the Covenant to, you know, this super secret underground organization. Like, that doesn't really bother me too much. Even with the Crystal Skulls, I never really was bothered by the whole, you know, otherworldly creature aspect. Like, that didn't concern me. Here's the thing. He made it work.
Yeah.
It's just that he kind of overlooked something. Because, again, Indiana Jones is still super fun to watch in this film.
Well, he is. And I think the ending sequence when they're on the rail cars is such a blast. I mean, I think that's so much fun to watch. Although it's ridiculous. I mean, it's completely ridiculous, but it's so much fun.
And, I just thought of this. You know, it kind of plays with, as the sequel, it plays with the first film, you know, changes up some scenes, you know, like there's the famous scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark where, you know, the guy wants to find with the story. He's just like, oh, the hell with this. Pulls up the gun, shoots him.
Exactly.
There's a repeat of that scene in this film where you got the two guys. And he tries to do it. He's like, gun doesn't work. He's like, oh, well. It reminded me a lot of, I know you're going to love me saying this, Spider-Man 2.
Oh, my gosh. Spider-Man 2.
Because it has that whole aspect of like, let's play with scenes from the first film in our sequel. But let's make it in a different way that kind of is justified and kind of fun.
It's funny, yeah, exactly. Indiana Jones, I can never say enough good things about Indiana Jones. Moving on, 1985, we have the introduction of Back to the Future, one of the best franchises ever made. I'm going to say that a lot throughout this episode. later in 1985, we have The Goonies, which was Amblin Entertainment, which is Steven Spielberg's company. He developed the story for The Goonies. Again, Goonies is one of my favorite films of all time. So we're not going to, you know, dwell on Goonies a lot because we just talked about Goonies in our episode earlier this week in our favorite film episode. Such a classic, one of the quintessential adventure films of the era. I mean, it makes kids want to, I mean, I know as a kid when I watched The Goonies, again, I was really lucky. My parents exposed me to some amazing movies as a kid. I know when I was a kid and I watched this, I thought it was possible to go find a pirate ship and a treasure. And if a movie can do that, I think it's winning.
I think the context of this episode with, you know, Spielberg, if you didn't even know who was involved directing, producing, or story-wise, it's like, hey, who do you think wrote the story? It's like, oh, Spielberg. Because it has all his tropes in it, but in a good way.
Yeah.
Because, again, these are well-developed characters. No matter who his main character is, he always puts the effort into it.
Yeah, like, no doubt.
Even though he's kind of criticized for having, you know, the typical, you know, protagonist, antagonist, you know, supporting cast, all that, he at least does a good job at making it work in the film he's making.
I agree. That's definitely a good point. Moving on, we have 1986. We're not going to dwell on 1986 or 1987 a whole lot. We're actually going to jump a few years ahead to 1988 when we have Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Yep. That's a good movie. Again, we talked about this, I believe, last episode, so we can't dwell on it a whole lot. Or was that two episodes ago? I don't know.
Somebody was watching.
We talk a lot, so it all just kind of runs together. Such a fun movie.
Yeah, and again, you know, we talked about, you know, the conflict of, you know, having to work with, you know, Disney, getting mm-hmm. all these things together, and, you know, to have him involved. You can probably tell watching the film, he was the man who was pulling some strings back. Hey,
absolutely.
Let this happen. It'll work. You'll be happy. We'll be happy. The audience. It's one of those things.
Yeah.
I think that's a good thing. He's a great filmmaker. He's also a fantastic businessman.
Oh, absolutely.
Entertainment. He understands both sides of the coin in film.
Yeah.
Which is so, you get these directors who are so hard pressed to be, you know, the filmmaker, the revolutionary artist, and like they just don't really care about the business side.
Yeah.
Then you had directors who, you know, I remember when I talked about Power Rangers, said you have these rented directors that are like,
absolutely,
they're here for the studio, like, hey, we have this property, make a film about it. I have no artistic creativity. Who cares? We just want the film to be.
Yeah, we just want money, right?
Yeah. That's what Spielberg, on the other hand, he can do both of those things.
Exactly. And that is the one thing I'll say about Spielberg. What I think he does even better than directing, and that's saying a lot, is executive producing.
Mm-hmm.
He is one of the best executive producers in Hollywood. He knows how to juggle because, I mean, producers, the job of a producer is often overlooked and I guess I could say romanticized it a bit. You know, when mm-hmm. someone tells you you're a producer, you want to be a producer, they're like, oh, you want to make movies. Well, there's a whole lot more to that. I mean, it's a creative aspect. It's a business aspect, as you're describing. It's a legal aspect. It's an intellectual property aspect, and it's all of those things working together at the same time and being able to juggle those things and make sure that everything that happens runs very seamlessly. And Spielberg knows how to do that because he just has those communication skills. He knows how to get in touch with the right people, build relationships with the right people, but at the same time, he's very creative, he's very business-driven, and it makes it work. I mean, it almost makes anything he does work.
And that's why we're including, you know, Spielberg's executive producing role. So, you know, you would think when you talk about a filmmaker, you're only going to talk about their director, producing, or screenwriting roles.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's that always a thing like, oh, this film has so-and-so as an executive producer, and you watch, like, that doesn't feel like they had much, you know, of a way of, you know,
exactly,
handling the film. When you see Spielberg's name on a film, even if he was just executive producer,
you can tell. You can.
You can. Oh, yeah. You can absolutely tell, like, yeah, Spielberg was definitely involved in this film.
You know what? Exactly. If he wasn't the director, he's nudging the director saying, why don't you try it this way? And the thing is, people are going to listen to Spielberg.
Oh, yeah.
No one's going to say no to Spielberg.
Here's the thing I'll say about him right now, even though we still have plenty of films to go off on. What's great about Steven Spielberg is that he's never really gotten bad.
Yeah.
He may have had, you know, periods of time in the early to mid-2000s where he wasn't, you know, constant quality, but I would never say he was, you know, at the point of, you know, his friend George Lucas, where he was like, clearly had that point. I was like, what are you doing?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, Steven, if you're listening, we're saying a lot of good things about you. You should come on the show, talk to us sometime. It'd be a good time.
How many people are we trying to get on the show right now?
Steven Spielberg, George Lucas. Let's see. Who else are we trying to get?
Quentin Tarantino.
Quentin Tarantino. Yeah, that'd be an interesting conversation. Moving on to 1989, we have Back to the Future Part 2, which is my favorite installment of that franchise. We have Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Fun movie.
Finally got Sean Connery on.
That's right.
That's
Sean Connery.
The idea of Harrison Ford and Sean Connery being, you know, this father and son,
it is great.
It's incredible.
And when they're riding on that bike together, that's, you know, that's one of the, with the sidecar, that's one of the coolest things ever. I mean, I know that's something I always have associated with Indiana Jones. It's such a classic duo.
It works so well.
It does
as
work.
The end of basically a trilogy.
Yeah, you're right. Then later on in 1990, we have Back to the Future Part 3.
I will say, this is probably my favorite Back to the Future.
Yeah, because you love Westerns.
And that whole aspect, it's almost like Doc Brown would have been perfect for that world.
Oh, absolutely.
And they hit the nail so perfectly there. Like, oh yeah, Doc Brown in the West, he's going to go crazy. Honestly, I can't say enough good things. I know there are people who are like, well, there's dumb scenes every now and then. It's like, for me, I love watching. It's a great escapism film.
Oh, absolutely.
And honestly, like, say with Indiana Jones, it's a great close to a trilogy.
Yeah.
Which is what's great when he does, you know, extra movies that, you know, tell a story. He knows how to end it.
Exactly. And kind of like we were talking this morning, you know, when you have a franchise like this, I believe we were talking about Jurassic Park, which we'll get mm-hmm. to later. Was it Jurassic Park? I don't remember what it was.
Most likely.
It was early. When I take something like Back to the Future, I like all three of the films. And it's hard to, it's like picking your, I guess you could say picking your least favorite child, because you love all of them. And it's like, which one do I like the least? You know, because they're, you're right. They're all so much fun and they're all, they all have so much escapism and they just take you to a different place. And I think Spielberg, kind of as you mentioned, he's incredibly consistent. And he's always, it's hard to find a bad egg in something he's had his hands on.
And you think you would be able to find something bad because, again, he's got a formula that he knows to apply to films.
Yeah.
But he knows how the genre and, you know, people he's using are going to fit into this formula.
Exactly. And then in 1991, we have several films, but my favorite of the ones in 1991 was Hook. He directed Hook. Such a fun movie. Obviously, you have Robin Williams, the late, great Robin Williams, playing Peter Pan. Just so much fun.
Just about to say, I mean, the idea of Spielberg and Robin Williams together, you know, at their creative peaks, at when everybody loved them, how could this not go
I know,
perfect?
It makes you wonder, what does Steven Spielberg do in Hollywood to be able to get... Here's the thing. There are a lot of times you have a great director and a subpar cast, or an incredible cast and a subpar director, but how often do you have an amazing director, an amazing cast, and an amazing crew? I mean, it seems fairly rare, and it seems like Steven Spielberg time and time again stumbles across this opportunity. Obviously, of course, by 1991, he's developed quite a name for himself. I mean, at this time, he's already established himself as one of the most successful directors in cinema history, so it's probably fairly easy for him. But as you mentioned, Spielberg, Robin Williams, come on, that's a dynamic duo, and it turned out to be an incredible film. I love Hook so much.
From what I've read, I mean, he seems like the most fun person to work with in film.
Yeah.
And again, you know, I get people will be like, well, look at the critical reviews of Hook. Again, maybe not the best film he's ever made, but you know what? I would say he got the point of fun.
Yeah.
Hook's a fun film.
It is, and some more John Williams music.
It's an interesting, you know, portrayal of, you know, the Peter Pan story, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, I agree. It's always fun to see the different takes because Peter Pan's an old story. As mentioned, Peter Pan's one of my favorite animated films of all time, and it's so neat to see the different adaptations and the different ways that one story can be told, and I think this is definitely one that's a lot of fun. And then moving into 1993, what we opened up our show with.
The big year.
Yes, big year. We have Jurassic Park, as mentioned. That's what we opened our show with, the music from Jurassic Park. Again, one of my favorite movies of all time. I think it's on my top 10. Again, my top 10 changes about every hour. Then later on that year, we have Schindler's List.
Which I wasn't alive when this came out, and even if I was, I probably would have been really young.
Yeah. Yeah.
the idea of him going from, you know, these escapism films, you know, these kind of by the books films in a way, if you would say, to something like that, that's a crazy thing to think about, how he made something which is honestly considered one of the greatest films of all time.
Oh, and yeah,
if you've seen Schindler's List, I'm not gonna lie, I kind of agree with that. And there's the criticism of, you know, the historical accuracy and, you know, his formula for characters and all that, but this is the one time where I think he really challenged himself as a filmmaker.
Oh, I agree.
And there's the fun backstory that this was technically a student film.
Yeah.
He was getting like his film degree because he never got it, correct?
Yep, correct. He never
and
graduated.
This is what he turned into a student film.
I mean, come on. That's, first off, that is not fair. You have unlimited resources, practically. Not fair for a student film, but yeah.
One of my favorite things about Schindler's List is actually during the Academy Awards, when they announced Spielberg as best director, you can hear Samuel Jackson's yelling, "About damn time." It's like, I agree. And you know what? This is probably the best way to win your first award like that. Again, definitely a feels trip.
It is.
He got Liam Neeson to be probably the greatest, give the greatest performance of his career.
Oh, I know.
The ending scene with Liam Neeson breaking
down.
Oh,
my gosh, I know.
Realizing how
so good.
Oh, just the amount of things that had to juggle at once and be not only, you know, of course, artistic, but also respectable.
Yeah.
That's a hard thing to do.
It is. Yeah.
Again, especially for this would be the last, one of the last things I would have thought Spielberg would have done.
Yeah.
Looking at, you know, what we just talked about. But again, he did it, and you can't deny, even if everyone says, Spielberg's never always does, you know, just these escapism films. Like, they want to be pretentious about, you know, filmmaking. You can look at Schindler's List. No, he did.
No, he did. He really went out of his comfort zone. And as you mentioned, such a big year for Steven Spielberg. I mean, going back to college, I mean, he graduated out of the Cal State school university system, getting the, you know, Academy Award for Best Director. You have Schindler's List. You have Jurassic Park. I mean, this could... We could arguably say this is the top notch. This is when we're seeing Steven Spielberg top notch. I mean, this is when he is officially the name of Hollywood. He is the man, you know, behind the Emerald Curtain, essentially, when it comes to Hollywood. I mean, it's incredible.
Jurassic Park basically started 90s filmmaking.
Yeah.
And Schindler's List was basically considered the greatest film of the 90s.
Exactly. And something that's so interesting about Spielberg, and I don't know if we've talked about this much in the past, is... It's common for people to know actors. That's obviously actors and actresses. That's common. You know, you have your favorite actors and you have your favorite actresses. And unless you're, I guess, kind of film buffs like us and the others listening who are also film buffs, it's, I guess, not the most common to have a favorite or to have a favorite list of directors or have people who at least know and can recognize a director. And Spielberg, this is when Spielberg was becoming a star as a director and as an executive producer, which wasn't the most common thing in the world. So, I mean, this is really, I mean, he's essentially achieving superstar status at this point, and he can essentially write his ticket to anything in Hollywood, which he had been doing for some time now. And, I mean, we definitely start to see that moving on. I mean, 1995, we have Casper. That's mm-hmm. a fun movie.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
Yeah. 96, we have Twister. I will say a fun movie.
Ultimate guilty pleasure of mine.
Exactly.
Bill Paxton is perfect.
Exactly.
In that movie.
Ridiculous movie, but so much fun.
And when I was younger, I liked storm chasing and all that.
I know.
I kind of still do. So this is probably the best way to do it.
Oh, I agree.
Do you remember when Bill Paxton passed away recently? They had the storm chasers at the memorial. I was like, oh.
That was so cool.
That's when you know you were involved in something that was very specific and important to a group of people.
Exactly.
That's great.
That's exactly right. And something I mean, anyone who knows me knows I'm a huge theme park, themed entertainment buff. I mean, arguably that's my mecca, even more so than movies. And for some people, they're like, what? You know, but Steven Spielberg's work with Universal Studios as a theme park and themed entertainment is incredible because he's able to, the two were able to tie so many of his great films into the theme parks. And you could go and experience all of these movies in person. And the reason I thought of this is because Twister was a former attraction at mm-hmm. Universal Orlando that you could go and experience, and you could you know, ride it out. You know, you could see Twister right in front of you, you know, and it just, again, that escapism. He makes something so surreal, but also so real that you can be transported into that place. So, yeah, such a fun movie. And then in 1997, we have The Lost World, Jurassic Park, followed by Men in Black. Another good movie. So much fun. 1998, I mean, this is just a decade that just keeps on going for this man. Saving Private Ryan in 1998.
Absolutely the best war film ever made.
Oh, no doubt.
I can't really... Yeah, I always try to be like, is there one better than that? And after I saw Saving Private Ryan, I was like, it kind of has to be the best because it feels like it.
It does, you're right. And then in 2001, we have Jurassic Park 3. And then 2002, we have his involvement, as an actor in Austin Powers and Goldmember.
I do want to say real quick, in 2001, when he did Artificial Intelligence,
yeah,
very special film for me because that was originally supposed to be a film Stanley Kubrick was going to make. And unfortunately, he passed away in 99 after Eyes Wide Shut.
Yep.
So Spielberg came in with Kathleen Kennedy to make the film. I'm not going to lie. After watching it, I think, you know what? I think Kubrick would approve.
And just as a heads up, Stanley Kubrick is Peter's boy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it kind of works hand in hand. Our next special series about filmmaking will be Stanley Kubrick, just a little heads up.
Easy,
so
easy.
It's always fun to kind of talk about your favorite person in the industry. And it's cool to see that that overlap between the two, because two very, very respected filmmakers. And it's kind of like you're saying, it's cool to see that he was able to kind of pick up where Stanley Kubrick left off.
I think that's a really cool thing, because, you know, again, it's like if anyone was probably going to be trusted to make that, I think Kubrick would have said, yeah.
Spielberg, give it to him, yeah.
You know, he understands genres. He understands characters. He clearly showed Schindler's List. He understood how to tell stories on a very high level.
Yeah.
Easy.
You're right. And then let's see here. We have Catch Me If You Can. That was later in 2002. skipping forward to 2004, The Terminal. Man, that was a fun movie.
Most people don't remember it existed.
I know, most people don't remember. It's fun.
It was a interesting film. It's kind of...
It's obscure, starring Tom Hanks. I don't know if you've seen it yet.
Had shades of, you know, again, the high-quality storytelling you saw in Schindler's List and Catch Me If You Can.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Then in 2005, we have War of the Worlds.
I got to say, again, clearly I'm the person who would love, you know, those classic, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s, you know, science fiction films. I don't mind it as much.
Yeah.
Listen, here's the thing. We'll do an episode on Tom Cruise, and I'll basically just fangirl the whole thing.
Yeah.
Because
I mean, for me, it's a guilty pleasure film. It really is.
Tom Cruise always works in these just weird films, you think.
He does.
Why is Tom Cruise in War of the Worlds? Well, reason why.
Reason why. Watch it, then you see it.
I still say the original is better, the book's better, but let's be real. This worked.
It does. I mean, a great adaptation of course, the Orson Welles classic, War of the Worlds. Then moving on, we have a lot to talk about here. I mean, and then in 2007, probably the film that causes the most arguments between Peter and myself, which we will leave that out of this episode, is Michael Bay's Transformers, where Steven Spielberg EP'd. Peter doesn't really know how he feels about it, I don't think. I really enjoyed Transformers 1. I enjoyed the 2007 Transformers.
I told you this morning, at least Transformers 1 tried to be a film. I can respect that. And here's the... I think the weirdest thing about this is, like, Steven Spielberg is involved in Transformers. It's like, yeah, look at this list. Yeah. Like, yeah, he is. But it's weird, because I said a while ago, you know, when Spielberg is acting as an executive producer, you can tell he's had that, you know, role in it.
Yeah.
Watching Transformers is kind of weird because, like, I'm not seeing the Spielberg touch.
See,
I am the Bay touch.
I see the Spielberg touch in very subtle ways. So you have the explosions. Mm-hmm. And I think that's signature Michael Bay. I think anyone who sees a Michael Bay movie, I will say Michael Bay's use of practical effects on a grand scale is incredible.
Oh, I mean, I respect him for that.
When he does an action scene, he is not a director that's going to be like, well, maybe more so now that we're getting into these really high fantasy versions of Transformers that I don't care for a whole lot. But the original Transformers, he's like, no, we're not going to do all green screen. We're actually going to have an entire city block. We're going to line it with cars. We're going to line it with controlled practical effects, and we're going to blow this place up.
He was in the second one, he was blowing stuff up near the pyramids.
I know.
That's insane.
It's insane, yeah. I mean, I can definitely respect him for that, but I will say...
Yeah, maybe that is the touch of Spielberg, like, hey, if you're going to blow something up, blow it up here.
Do it. Exactly. Don't CGI the whole thing. Actually do it. And I think the other small touch, which kind of goes unrecognized, is Steven Spielberg's kind of... I guess I want to say love for nostalgia and I guess paying homage to the past and originality. What some people don't realize is Peter Cullen, the original voice of Optimus Prime,
from the 80s was, cartoon.
Exactly, was also the voice in the 2007 film and has been, you know, since then. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the small touch of Spielberg that I really respect, because hearing Peter Cullen's voice as Optimus Prime is... it's just amazing. It gives me goosebumps.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Doesn't Peter Cullen also do the voice of Winnie the Pooh?
Yeah, it's like, let me fact check that.
I will say, because as of now recording, we're going to have a Transformers film coming out later this summer.
Yeah.
And I guarantee we'll definitely be, Peter Cummings, I think, is the voice of Winnie the Pooh.
Okay, yeah, I was like, I was like, man, he has a very rich baritone voice to be playing Winnie the Pooh. But then again, look at Paul Frees. He played some crazy voices, and he was also the ghost host from the Haunted Mansion, so you never know.
It'd be cool, though.
That would be cool. Let's just act like he was the voice of Winnie the Pooh.
Somebody make a version of... Somebody, like, edit Transformers where Winnie the Pooh is doing Optimus Prime's lines.
That'd be great. The AllSpark.
But yeah, one of the weird things is... But again, we're going to save Transformers for a future episode down the road.
There's a lot to be said about the Transformers franchise.
This will be the one. That'll be the episode where you and me definitely argue.
Yeah, Peter and I will be punching each other in that episode. So you're going to make sure
stick around.
You don't want to miss that one. Yeah,
we'll open with the Rocky theme.
Yeah, exactly. In 2008, we have Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Oh, we're going to ignore that one even happened.
You know what? No. You keep it there.
Oh, that was terrible. It took. I don't even have words. I mean, he gets in a lead-lined refrigerator and he survives a nuclear blast. And that's how you start this movie. That's why this famous story about Jaws, when Steven Spielberg says, if I can keep them in it for 2 hours, they're going to believe anything I do at the end. Well, Steven, you're not going to keep me in it if you set off a nuclear bomb and you have Harrison Ford in a lead-lined refrigerator and you expect me to believe he lives. You had me out of it immediately.
First of all, I think that may have been a more Lucas decision. Because behind the scenes, if you listen to interviews on Crystal Skull, Spielberg was like, I'm done with Indiana Jones. I don't want to do it.
True.
Of course, you had Lucas be like, let's do this again.
Oh, let's do this again. Fun. Yeah. Oh, wow. That's be great.
Here's the controversial Peter Lewis belief about Crystal Skull. I don't mind it that much.
Yeah. And honestly, fair enough.
That scene, I kind of like because
I know you're definitely into that, like, Fallout atmosphere, yeah, too. So.
Does it push the boundaries of suspension of disbelief? Which, again, in escapism, I'm going to be a lot very...
cynical?
No, not that. A little more reasonable.
Fair enough.
Like, what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
And I saw what they were trying to do, but again, I understand, like, I feel like that's pushing, especially like, what if the refrigerator didn't land
exactly
the right way up?
And the way it lands, I mean, it just like, it tumbles and he gets out unharmed. Mm-hmm. Well, let's not talk about radiation. Let's not talk about anything else. The fact that he'd probably be burned alive upon exiting that thing. But anyways, that's just being ridiculous.
Andy Jones is just a badass.
He is. That's all we can say.
But
yeah.
I'm not going to lie. The Russian thing kind of worked. The Cold War vibe worked for
me. Yeah, I can agree with that.
It was
that.
A good replacement for the Nazis.
I can definitely agree with that.
The whole storyline about, you know, I didn't really mind Shia LaBeouf.
Yeah, fair enough.
I didn't like the idea of the kid kind of was a little weird at times, but the character itself, not too much.
Yeah, I can agree.
I didn't mind the aliens because, you know, what was good about almost all the Indiana Jones films, they were based on something that was, you know, mythic or fantasy in reality in some way, shape, or form. And again, the way they just use these aliens, they're not from outer space. They're like from a... dimension, I believe it was. I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
Was the UFO a little too much? Sure.
But you do make a lot of good points. And I've never, I guess, come out and said that I've hated this film. Mm-hmm. It's definitely not my favorite at all.
It is the new black sheep. Like
It's definitely the worst of Indiana Jones.
It's like Temple of Doom. I am sorry. You are not as bad
exactly.
as I thought.
But kind of like you're saying, I can watch it and be entertained. No doubt. But if I have to choose Indiana Jones, I'm choosing Raiders first and foremost, but then I'm going to pick any of the original three before I pick. Then again, I shouldn't say that. About 3 weeks, two or 3 weeks ago, I sat and watched this one just because. I was like, you know what? I've got to watch it and just turn it on.
I still think the Last Crusade, that the ending shot is my canonical ending shot.
Yeah.
But, you know, as a joke, I think like, what did Indiana Jones do after? Because he's got to still make money. He's got to make a job.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is what he probably would
do. There you go. Yeah, fair enough.
It's a weird thing. It didn't go anywhere for more films. Well, the reboot at least.
Well, yeah, we've got.
But you know what?
Hold on to your seats. We got more coming up.
So that's basically that's the outlier of, I think he's had recently, even more than Transformers, I would say.
Yeah, that's true. Well, in 2009, we have Transformers: Revenge of the Fallen.
Again, we're saving those for another time.
Going to save those. Let's see here. Moving forward,
2011, I believe, was Super 8, which God, I love that movie.
Yeah, that was a good movie.
That was a special movie.
Yeah, that's true. We also have Dark of the Moon. Sorry, again, we won't talk about that one. This is when my love for Transformers starts kind of dissipating, and then. I guess, let's see here, 2014. Well, 2012, we have Men in Black 3, which is, you know.
Not bad.
Then we have Lincoln.
Good film.
Good movie. Yeah, good film. And then 2014, we have Transformers Age of Extinction. And this is by this point, I'm just like, okay, what's going on here with Transformers? 2015, we have the Poltergeist remake, like the reboot sort of, yeah, no.
Here's the funny thing about that. I saw that in theaters because I got dragged into it. Literally the next morning, I forgot I saw it.
Yeah.
I was like...
Now that's when you know a movie is good.
I literally don't... I was so shocked. I was like, it's not even been 12 hours. I just don't even remember the film.
Yep.
So that's quality right there.
That is quality.
That's the Peter Lewis review, 10 out of 10
right
there.
That's right. 2015, later that year, we have Jurassic World. You know what? I don't hate it. I actually enjoy it. I love the concept. We were briefly talking about this before the episode started. I actually really like the concept.
Oh, the idea of seeing the park actually open.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I believed it. The only thing I disagreed with was the idea is like, we're having trouble getting people to come. It's like, okay, that is a lie.
Yeah.
If Jurassic Park World was IRL, you would have a 50-year waiting list for people to come there.
Exactly. So I agree. That kind of took the suspension of disbelief, took away the escapism a little bit, because they're trying to act like, well, no one's excited by dinosaurs anymore, so let's create this monster killer.
Sure they aren't.
Yeah, exactly. But I didn't. I like Chris Pratt in the movie. I love Chris Pratt altogether.
It's hard to hate him.
Exactly.
And his chemistry of Bryce Dallas Howard, I liked it.
I did too. I really did. Now, the ending of the film, I thought it was a little force-fed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I always love, as we kind of talked about, it's always great to see the T-Rex win.
Mm-hmm.
Spoiler alerts. I mean, if you haven't seen it, it's been out for a while, so if you haven't seen it, sorry. But the whole Mosasaur, come on. Like, that was too much.
And again, it's kind of almost like a sequel remake of Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, which...
It really kind of is.
It's kind of the new thing in Hollywood. Like, let's not remake the film, because people aren't going to agree with that, but let's make it another sequel, of course, but kind of have it change the game.
Kind of like Terminator, Force Awakens.
That's what Terminator Genesis did. Oh,
yeah.
It gets a Force Awakens. Terminator Genesis did that. I was like, oh, John Connor's going back in time. Oh, sorry, John, the time John sent you back to doesn't exist anymore. Sorry, Kyle Reese was the guy who sent it back. I was like, what is going on in this film?
Yeah.
And that's kind of what Jurassic World, not to a horrible extent as Terminator Genesis did.
Yeah. Whew.
If we ever get around to that, that'll be a fun episode.
Yeah, no kidding.
But it's just, it worked, it didn't work. I think it's middle of line.
Yeah, fair enough. I agree. And later that year, we have Bridge of Spies. And
that's probably the one Spielberg film I have not liked.
Yeah.
It was the idea that you could make the Cold War, especially that moment in time, boring with Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, fair enough. Peter loves the Cold War, folks. Then 2016.
We need to bring it back.
probably not. 2016, we have The Big Friendly Giant. And then kind of a little foreshadowing. We're not going to talk a whole lot about this. We do have Transformers The Last Knight.
Amazed he's still executive producing.
It's like, when is he going to disassociate himself? Because he has to recognize that it's going downhill.
Because I kind of agree with you when you brought up, the hints of Spielberg in the first one, 2007.
Yeah.
You kind of can't say there's been hints of him in
two,
three, or four.
At least the 2007 film was kind of nostalgic in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very Spielberg to me. But this one is just like Lord of the Rings meets Transformers meets, I don't even know.
I think we joked.
Alien? I don't know.
I think we joked in our summer preview that if their new goal, because there's supposed to be 13 more of these films.
Oh my gosh.
If the goal is to put them in historical settings, if I have a Transformers film in the Civil War, I'm not going to lie, I'll hate it.
But he'll watch it.
Oh, I will. I'll paint a seat a lot of times.
And then later, we have Jurassic World 2, Indiana Jones 5. We're not going to dwell on any of those, of course, but...
Technically not even out yet.
Yeah, technically not out.
Just listening to the idea of an Indiana Jones reboot.
Yeah.
I know Chris Pratt's, I think, supposed to be it.
Yeah.
Which, again, love Chris Pratt.
Love Chris Pratt.
He's the new good everyman for these films, but really...
We shall see.
Do you have to remake every film?
I know. Well, we just covered from approximately 1974-ish all the way till now.
And I think we basically showed what's good about Spielberg.
Yeah, in about 48 minutes. I was going to say...
Second longest episode.
I know. Do we talk about the tactics he used? But we kind of talked about those throughout the entire episode as we kind of discussed. So, to wrap it up, top three Spielberg movies, go.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, if you need a second, think
Close
about
Encounters.
It. We can play Jeopardy music or something.
I'll say Close Encounters at number three, Raiders at number two. And probably Jurassic Park at number one.
Yeah, fair enough. Mine, I think for three, it's going to be Jurassic Park. Number two is going to be Jaws. And number one is going to be Raiders of the Lost Ark. And, of course, I do have to put an honorable mention for Hook. I love Hook so much. Then again, I could probably I could be very satisfied with the top 10 favorite movies, and all of which Spielberg had a hand in. But I don't know. I have to have my Wizard of Oz in there.
When you
sometime.
Did your top 10 list the other day, it's understandable why there'd be so much Spielberg, because let's be real, he understands what people want to see.
And, I mean, you can call it cliche. And we've had this conversation. Peter likes pretentious movies. Let's just say it like that. There's nothing wrong with that.
Listen, I had Clerks on my top 10. I think that disqualifies me as a pretentious person to begin with.
Call me a lazy movie guard, but I just love Spielberg. I love he understands this pathos, sort of this emotional appeal. It works. It works in so many ways. And I mean, of course, Wizard of Oz is always my number one, but that's beside the point.
Do I like to watch 2001 and Godfather a lot? I do, but every now and then, I want to watch The Goonies.
Yeah,
I'm not
you
gonna
have
lie,
to have The Goonies.
I kind of want to watch The Goonies a little more than Godfather right now.
Fair, hey, I agree. Fair enough.
I'm never going to get to vote in the Academy, so I'm fine with that.
Exactly. You know, The Godfather, I mean, I know that's not what this episode's about. You have a lot of movies like that. Like, you really have to, like, you have to be ready to watch them, you know? And I feel like all of Spielberg's films, you can watch them at any time.
But you can always watch, like...
Exactly.
I know some people who love film, seen The Godfather, like, I've seen it once, that's all I need to see.
Yeah.
Goonies? Oh.
I couldn't tell you how many times I watch it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Because it's always fun. That's the good thing. It's like, you know it by heart, but you still want to keep watching it.
Yeah. Exactly right.
I think that's a testament to succeeding in film. Because the worst thing you can make is something that's good, but no one ever wants to watch again.
Yep, you're right. Well, do you have anything else to say about my boy Steven Spielberg, Peter?
I understand why you like him.
Exactly.
I've talked about him for 50 minutes. You know what? I think it's understandable why he gets the reputation he does.
So, Steven, if you're listening, go ahead and come on the show. You can call us at 573-651-5070. Give us a call. It's at KRCU headquarters here. Swing on by and talk to us sometime. You never know. He might be listening. Odds are he's not. Especially, he's not going to be listening after 50 minutes. But anyway, so as mentioned, the next time we do a special like this, we'll be talking about Stanley Kubrick. And that's Peter's right-hand man, so that should be a fun episode.
And then we'll, I guess that on top of that, we'll probably have Lucas eventually.
Of course.
You have to.
You have to have him. Alfred Hitchcock. I mean, there are just people in the industry. You have to dedicate an episode
to. I'll make
to.
You suffer with me talking about Quentin Tarantino for 50 minutes.
I'll set through Quentin Tarantino, and then we have to talk about M. Night Shyamalan Ding Dong, too.
Absolutely.
Got to talk about all of them.
I want to have him on the show.
Let's have him on the show. He'd probably tell some story, and at the end, he'd change everything about it, and then we'd just all be
it's
confused.
Like, what
and then
a twist.
Be over. Exactly. He'd have a great twist to the show. But anyways, as always, check us out on iTunes, the Google Play Store, KRCU.org. And you can also check us out on KRCU's Facebook page. So get on your Facebook, type in KRCU, give it a like. You can follow everything that we're doing. Again, as mentioned, we have a lot of cool summer series stuff coming up. You can see what the station's doing. And, you know, just kind of stay in the loop. It's always fun to stay in the loop with your favorite shows and your favorite content. And I think Real Talk should be, you know, some of your favorite content. And if not, that's fine. Whatever.
We're giving you everything, but that's fine.
If you don't like Real Talk, you probably like 2001 A Space Odyssey. And we won't judge you because of, I'm just kidding. So
it's like, where are you going? That's a strange. Of all the films you could have said, like, why did you go to that one?
Okay. You like Transformers 3.
There we go.
That's better, right? No.
Jesus.
So as always.
We just lost half the viewers.
As always, for Real Talk, I'm Colin Ritter.
I'm Peter Lewis. We're going to cut that last part out.
We'll see you at the movies, and we'll play you out with E.T.